District 5 Pee Wee Hockey Team. I'm Gordon Bombay. I'm the new coach.
The Knuckle Puck. The Flying V. Goldberg the Goalie. These phrases all became part of the universal hockey lexicon the moment a Disney movie about a group of mischievous kids captured the hearts of sports fans and filmgoers alike.
Here's the long and the short of it. I hate hockey and I don't like kids.
It was supposed to be a pep talk.
Yep, the Mighty Ducks. When it was first released in 1992, no one could have possibly predicted how a Disney movie would forever alter the face of the sport. We're talking a film trilogy, action figures, a Saturday morning cartoon, a streaming reboot, and of course, an actual National Hockey League franchise. But in order to understand how all this actually happened, we have to first go back to this. You may not recognize that sound, so I'll help you out. That is a typewriter. More importantly, that's the sound Steve Brill generated in the late 1980s after working as a production assistant for the legendary director Norman Jewison, hoping for a big break that never came.
I, for some reason, made the mistake thinking that one day he would turn to me and say, "This is good coffee. Write me a screenplay." It never happens.
At a crossroads in his career, Brill decided to write that script anyway. And, like all good writers, he wrote about something he loved. Hockey.
I just hunkered down there and wrote all day and all night for many months and came up with a draft of the Mighty Ducks.
I'm Ardo Ocal, and welcome to the premiere episode of NHL Backstory, a spirited, lighthearted podcast journey deep into some of the fun, pivotal moments in the history of hockey. This is episode one. Quack, quack, quack.
I did two TV shows before Ducks. One starred an actor named Brad Pitt, and one starred an actor named George Clooney. And I don't know what happened to either of them, but I know what happened to me.
And what happened to Steve Brill was, well, nothing at first.
He took it around on his own and pitched it to every studio. They all passed. And that's why his agent came to me and we started to work together.
That's producer Jordan Kerner.
He did three drafts of it and we added the whole Emilio story of he was sad because his father had died young and the opposite coach was really his dad, but he was not a good dad. So that Emilio's character would be someone who had a big emotional journey to travel.
As luck would have it, one major studio was going through its own transition. And the new studio boss was a big sports fan.
I am Michael Eisner, previous CEO and chairman of the Walt Disney Company. I was a New York Giant fan, and when they left New York, I had a complete breakdown. I'm still upset about it, actually.
Eisner had previously enjoyed success with sports films during his tenure as head of Paramount Pictures.
Particularly the Bad News Bears, Walter Matthau. So that was the impetus of, well, we could do something like that with hockey.
Steve Brill was inspired by that movie as well.
Bad News Bears was just a mess if you watch that, as far as how aggressive and funny and raunchy and dirty, and now very politically incorrect, but back then, it was my favorite.
Brill's protagonist, Coach Gordon Bombay, was named after two brands of gin. But he wasn't nearly the drunken louse that Walter Matthau portrayed in Bad News Bears. Then again, Bad News Bears was released in 1976. It was a different time, to put it mildly. By the early 1990s, Eisner saw potential in a similar story set in the hockey rinks of Minnesota. And his studio badly needed a hit.
Disney was in a fight then for his life, having had quite a depressing period since Walt Disney died. They were about to be taken over.
With a green light from Disney and Emilio Estevez playing Coach Bombay, production started with an extensive casting call. It didn't take long for producer Jordan Kerner to realize they weren't going to find kids who could skate like Orr and act like Olivier.
It was a nationwide search, and we had to establish from the very beginning that we would want to have some kids who did play hockey or who figure skated. And then we would teach them acting. Some of the kids would be stronger actors, but we would have to teach them hockey.
Kerner needed Disney approval on every young actor cast in the film. So he had to get creative when he tabbed a young actor named Eldon Ratliff to play Fulton Reed, the towering intimidator whose thunderous slapshot turns around the Mighty Ducks season.
When we showed his tape and we said, isn't he fantastic? You know, and all that to the studio who had to approve each of them. They were all like, what's the matter with you guys? He's not tough looking. We were all crestfallen. And ultimately, I felt he was the right one. And the studio was short-sighted. And what we did is we dyed his hair black. We put a scar on his face, darkened his eyebrows, put him in lifts, and we dressed him up in like an army fatigue jacket and cargo pants. Oh, and we renamed him. We gave him a new name. Instead of Eldon Ratliff, we made him Pete Quinn. I just thought an Irish name, it just sort of popped out of me. So when he stood up and he does his reading, hi, I'm Pete Quinn, I'm reading for the role of Fulton. The studio looked at it and one of them turned to me and said, see, you didn't listen to us. And now you really have a great kid. This guy is Fulton. This guy is scary and he's gonna be tough, you know, and all of that. And I went, oh my God, no, thank you. You're absolutely right.
Just like a real hockey team, the cast was forced to endure an intense training camp before filming began in Minnesota. And Jack White, the man tasked with turning these child actors into hockey players, knew what he was doing, having served in that same role in classic hockey films like Youngblood and The Cutting Edge.
They were very respectful of Jack White, even though he probably made them crazy sometimes because he was very serious about it.
That's Lois Jaworzewski. She was the on-set teacher and welfare worker for all three Mighty Ducks movies.
He was a fun guy, but there was no playing around. I mean, these kids came out, take a knee, right away, take a knee.
I'm going to go ahead and say it was harder on me to learn how to skate than all the other guys just because I was shaped like a beach ball.
That's actor Sean Weiss.
I think it was hard for him to keep me motivated, so he kind of just brought this character out of me that was like, come on, turn into this kind of animal guy. Just like egging me on to just be more ferocious.
This is what you might call the origin story of Goldberg the goalie.
It probably took 6 months for them to cast that part, and they kept having me go back every month or so, reading the same line over and over again. I am a took the goalie, I am a took the goalie. And I don't know, I wasn't getting any better, so I didn't really understand what was going on. I got to training camp and it was a took the goalie. And I guess just throughout the course of the first training camp, I don't know, I guess they figured I was kind of a smartass, so they would kind of mold the character into that kind of voice.
The kids in the film were mostly featured as an ensemble, but Goldberg the goalie was the closest thing to a breakout character. He was featured in the film's poster and was the central figure in what remains to this day one of the film's most memorable scenes. In the scene, Coach Gordon Bombay ties Goldberg to the net and the team lines up to pelt him with a barrage of slap shots.
I remember having horrible diarrhea that day. Why, God, would you do that to me on the day that I'm chained up like this for 9 hours?
I am Goldberg, the goalie!
Somebody got the bright idea. This kid's not tortured enough. Let's pretend to leave him there and go to lunch.
And nobody untied him.
That's Lois Jaworzewski again.
And we're leaving. My heart, I was like, I can't do this to the kid. I can't. I love him so much. So we all left. We left the entire place.
Hey, guys. Excuse me, guys. You got to untie me now. Good joke. Very funny.
That wasn't the only hardship the young cast had to endure.
I feel like filming in the winter in Minnesota was like earning your stripes.
That's Marguerite Moreau. She played Connie Moreau, a.k.a. the Velvet Hammer, in all three of the Mighty Ducks films.
It was freezing. I mean, we had things taped to us and stuffing feet with four pairs of socks and wrapping us in huge coats, trying to keep warm.
How cold was it? Producer Jordan Kerner remembers one scene, filmed at an ice sculpture festival, where Emilio Estevez and his love interest shared a kiss.
I hear the AD say to me, you've got to come over here quick. Their lips are stuck together, 50 below zero. So I said, get some warm water quick. you know, and somebody got some hot water and we slowly put it on their lips and they were able to disengage.
Despite the sub-zero temperatures, the young actors became fast friends.
It was just a great group and they loved each other. And by the way, they still do.
Like, we were just all fast friends. We were just like, we were all there on a singular mission and we were all kind of having this same similar experience for the first time. It was kind of like actually being put with a real team of guys is actually how it felt. Still feels like that kind of, we still feel like a team of guys or like a family.
On the last day of the shoot, there was like a tagline thrown in that wasn't in the script that Emilio did off the bus.
No matter what happens, we'll see you next season. We got a title to defend.
We just went berserk. All the kids were just like, oh my God. Because like, I didn't know, it was my first movie. I was like, I'll see you soon to like every crew member. And they were like, no. And I was like, what? I don't understand.
When the Mighty Ducks became one of 1992's breakout box office hits, Disney called screenwriter Steve Brill, and he heard one of the most beautiful words in the English language, sequel. Up next, Steve Brill gets to work on D2, and Disney approaches the NHL with a revolutionary idea. More NHL backstory in a moment.
What's up, hockey fans? It's Nick Elberga with my main man, Pete Jensen.
How's it going, everybody? We're checking in to tell you all about NHL Fantasy on Ice.
Now, Petey, I might be a bit biased, but it really is the best fantasy hockey podcast out there.
Nick, man, the charts tell the whole story here with a number one draft pick.
That's right, and we help fantasy hockey fanatics win championships. That's just what we do, Pete.
Absolutely. We cover it all from the start of free agency all the way to your championship week with all the season preview episodes, mock drafts, stat projections to get you prepped.
I mean, what more can you ask for? Throughout the season, we pump out 3 episodes a week and are joined by expert guests who offer up top-notch analysis.
We got your lineup locks, sleepers, rookies, waiver wire pickups, the whole deal.
NHL Fantasy on Ice is a must listen to set you up for season-long success in fantasy hockey.
And we also sprinkle in some wagering advice on every show.
And here's some advice for you. Subscribe to NHL Fantasy on Ice. It's available on NHL.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's free to subscribe. Come join the family. It's an absolute no-brainer if you're looking to win your fantasy hockey title.
The movie came out in October, and around November, I got a call to come in to see Eisner, and he said, we need a sequel. I was so excited, and he said, I need a script in 2 weeks, which was crazy. That never happens in Hollywood. I wanted to bring in new characters, international characters, so it was just fun to just get it all out. And I wrote, I thought, pretty much close to the script that is Ducks 2 in about 2 to 3 weeks, and they were like, great.
Disney would soon have bigger plans for the Mighty Ducks than just a sequel. It started when Michael Eisner learned about a brand new arena being built in Anaheim, California, practically next door to Disneyland. It had 17,250 seats, 5,400 parking spaces, 82 luxury suites, and 250,000 square feet of marble adorning the concourse. What it didn't have was a tenant. And that's where this guy comes in.
So my name is Bruce McNall. I was the former owner of the Los Angeles Kings. Richard Ablon, who's a great man, was the president of Ogden Corporation. Oddly enough, they decided for unknown reason to build an arena in Anaheim. And he came to me and he said, look, we need a tenant. Donald Sterling, obviously the owner of the Clippers, would be the obvious person because they are now playing in the sports arena, which held about 2,000 people. It was just a horrible place to play basketball.
McNall helped broker a deal for the Clippers to play in Anaheim instead.
Literally, it was ready to be signed. And Sterling would have made $20 or $25 million a year more money playing in that arena. So I thought it was a no-brainer. At the last minute, Sterling said, it's too far for me to drive. I don't want to drive that far. So he passed on the deal.
McNall's eureka moment came when he started searching for a group in Anaheim that possessed both the money and interest to invest in a pro sports team.
Disney. So I went to Michael Eisner, who I had known from the film business before, and said, Michael, how about considering buying a franchise for hockey in Anaheim? And he said, no, that's crazy.
Once again, Michael Eisner.
I was in the shower where I do a lot of my thinking, and I thought, why not? And I called Bruce McDonald and said, yeah, we'd like to do this.
Weeks later, Eisner was walking into the NHL governor's meeting in Palm Beach, Florida.
I asked somebody to send me a sweatshirt because I was in Florida, I guess, and a Mighty Ducks sweatshirt arrived and I put it on. And I walked into the meeting and they asked me what the name of the team would be. I had the sweatshirt on with the logo from the movie and I said, we're the Mighty Ducks.
There was some protest, obviously, from some of the owners who felt that that just was inappropriate to have a name after a Disney movie, and especially a duck. It just sounds silly to them. But once again, Michael, the good salesman he was, I think he explained to him why, and pretty soon everybody said, okay, let's do it.
What followed were a lot of late nights, especially for one lawyer working for Disney at that time.
My name's Kevin Gilmore. I was a lawyer in the legal department and then basically handled a department called corporate alliances, so sponsorship deals that basically went from A to Z. One day, the VP that I worked for just popped into my office and said, you're Canadian, right? I said, yes. He goes, do you know anything about hockey? And I said, of course I know about hockey. And he said, well, why don't you come with me? Michael Eisner has got this idea of getting into the hockey business. Michael was a visionary. From the very beginning, he was focused on the team being called the Mighty Ducks. And at some point, someone brought up, well, should we do focus groups or really do market research? He goes, I've done my market research. I've got 150 million reasons why. And that was basically the domestic box office gross for the Mighty Ducks movie.
On December 10th, 1992, barely 2 months after the Mighty Ducks premiered in movie theaters, the National Hockey League officially awarded an expansion franchise to the Walt Disney Company.
Flash forward to February of 1993. I'm on a flight to Montreal for the All-Star Game. I'm sitting in business class. I'm talking to a guy beside me. He asks me what I do. He looks at me and he goes, that's my kid's second favorite team. I'm like, what? He hadn't even started playing yet.
NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman was hired the day after Anaheim was awarded its franchise, and he wasn't worried about the name of the team.
I was more focused on the fact that at the time, the Walt Disney Company was going to own a franchise, and their ability to market and promote using the amazing assets they had, I thought would be good for the game in terms of visibility and engaging young people.
The team still had no logo, no uniforms, no players, no internal staff, nothing. But Michael Eisner was always up for a challenge.
The logo was one of the most funs because they're probably, I'm making this up, 30 divisions inside Disney, and they all have artists, and they all work all the time. So I created a competition, and I asked every division, Walt Disney World, Disneyland, the Motion Picture Group, the Television Group, every group, advertising group, give me a logo.
I remember talking to some people at Imagineering, and it was like, this was so different for them. They're building rides, they're building this, they're doing that. They get to be creative, but this is like, oh my God, this is sports. We've never done this before, right? So they were so excited to help out. It was great.
The Imagineering team came up with a duck-billed goalie mask for a logo and purple and teal as their official team colors. Meanwhile, D2, the Mighty Ducks, was bringing the gang back together.
All right, Ducks, show them what you got. Let's scrimmage.
D2 was a celebratory reunion for the original film's cast, but there were a number of new characters that were added to the sequel, including one played by a young actor who had started gaining a following thanks to his star turn on Nickelodeon.
And I'm getting sick of seeing the USA represented by a bunch of whining babies. But too bad you can't back up that mouth. Man, me and my boys can take you anytime, anywhere.
That's a young Kenan Thompson. Today, he's the most tenured cast member in the history of Saturday Night Live, and arguably one of the funniest people on television. On-set tutor Lois Yaroshevsky remembers him as one of her best students.
I'll tell you a good Kenan story. They had a party for us. It was a huge party, and we all went, and it was fabulous. And they had jet skis, and everybody was going out. All the kids were taking out the jet skis. It was great. And Kenan didn't. And at the very end of the day, Kenan said, you want to take a jet ski with me? So he took one, I took one. We go out on the jet skis, and now we're having fun. And we go, and having a great time, until all of a sudden, Kenan's like, you hear putt, putt, putt. has ran out of gas and he's scared. He's not a big water person either. So I try to go over to him and mine, put out of gas. So there's two of us in the middle of this lake and it's getting dark. What happened was this boat came and I'm flagging them down. And I said, can you please tow us in? And it was Keenan, right? So they hadn't seen him in the movie yet because this is part two. And so I'm saying, do you know the Mighty Ducks? And the kids are like, yeah, yeah. And I said, he's in the Mighty Ducks. They're like, no, he's not. And I'm like, listen, I promise you when we get to where you're taking us, you will meet all the Mighty Ducks. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, of course, we got there. They're all screaming, where were you? They're freaking out. And then the kids were happy and they saw the Mighty Ducks and end of story. Thank goodness.
While Disney appeared to be seamlessly expanding the Mighty Ducks film franchise, their NHL franchise was scrambling to build a team. And with the expansion draft and amateur draft fast approaching, finding a general manager would be one of their biggest tasks.
I'm Jack Ferrer. I was the original GM here with the Ducks, and I was with them for 5-6 years, whatever it was. When I got the job, well, they made the announcement, I had to go up to Disney headquarters in Burbank. So he says, you got to go to this room. And I said, well, where is it? And the guy says, you go down. And that when you see the picture of Goofy, you take a right, and then you go into the room. And then I had to go somewhere else. And it was like, yeah, go by Pluto. There's the other room. And I'm just saying, what I got myself into here.
The team mostly found retreads in the expansion draft, players looking for a new lease on their respective careers. But if they were going to find a true superstar to lead the team, that player was going to come in the entry draft. Ferreira and his staff identified that star in Paul Kariya, a forward at the University of Maine, who in just one season had already established himself as one of the best players in college hockey history.
We went to the college playoffs and a regional game was in Worcester. So we were watching Paul and it was the first two periods of the game. And I knew right then he's the guy that I wanted. So I said, let's get out of here. I said, I don't want anybody to think I like him. And so we left. He was exciting and we're entertainers. That's what I wanted. Somebody that could put up and get the people at the edge of their seats.
Hi, I'm Paul Kariya, left wing of the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. Well, the only team that interviewed me were the Hartford Whalers, and they were drafting second. So I had no idea that the Ducks were interested. I just thought being an expansion team, having the Disney angle of the Mighty Ducks, I thought it was a really unique team to start with, and maybe as a young player coming in, it would give me more opportunities to have a bigger role starting with the team.
In just a few months, the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim had hired a staff, introduced their logo and uniforms, found a coach and GM, and built their expansion roster. Their arena had even opened for business, hosting a Barry Manilow concert in one of its first open events. On the surface, it appeared as if everything was humming. Behind the scenes, it wasn't quite so seamless. Here's lawyer Kevin Gilmore.
We didn't get possession of our office space in the building until maybe a couple weeks before the season started. And the first event at the pond was the circus. 2 days after the circus vacates, we move in, and it smells like animals. And I walk into my office, and I look down on the carpet, and there's the outline of clown shoes. A clown from the circus had basically come into my office, probably used it to change, and repainted his shoes in yellow. So I had these yellow outlines of clown feet on the carpet in my office. That's how last minute it was.
On October 8th, 1993, less than 10 months after the NHL awarded Anaheim an expansion franchise, the Mighty Ducks opened their season. Their opponent that night? A Detroit Red Wings team stacked with future Hall of Famers. Steve Yzerman, Sergei Fedorov, Nick Lidstrom, Dino Cicerelli, Paul Coffey, and Scotty Bowman, the winningest coach in NHL history, making his debut behind their bench. Spoiler alert, the Mighty Ducks lost that night in a game that wasn't quite as memorable as the pregame festivities.
Esteemed hockey fans, it is with deepest pride and greatest pleasure that we welcome you tonight to the pond. We invite you to relax and take your seat as the
Okay, stay with me here. That is Lumiere from the Disney animated film Beauty and the Beast. He was one of numerous Disney characters featured throughout the game. The opening night festivities also included an appearance from the Iceman, a rock and roll mascot of sorts, who appeared on the ice with a guitar strapped to his chest to sing the team's first official anthem, Rock the Pond. Now's a good time to remind you that this was the 1990s.
He's standing on the back of the Zamboni, on cleats, climbs down onto the ice, struts around, does his stuff.
That's John Bisaha, the singer and co-writer of Rock the Pond.
It was awesome. So he killed it for a little while, but I don't know if he caught on really well with the crowd there at the pond. I think he lasted maybe the first 5-10 games, and then they kind of did away with the Iceman.
Kevin Gilmore forgot about the short-lived career of the Iceman, but he does remember what happened after the game was over.
We lost to Detroit 5-2, I think. And after the game, I remember sitting in the stands and the building was empty. I was like, wow, this actually happened. This is real. That's the moment where it sunk in for me that this was actually, okay, we did this and now it's just starting.
Those early days were just as surreal for actor Marguerite Moreau.
I felt like the NHL team was my team from the second that it was announced. And then the fact that it was my local hockey team. Once I wore my jersey to a game and it had my name on the back, and a guy was like, Moreau, I love that player. And I just was like, he doesn't know. You know, it's like a very fun secret.
Despite that opening night loss, the Mighty Ducks were actually pretty good in their inaugural season. Behind head coach Ron Wilson, they won 33 games and finished fourth in the Pacific Division, ahead of their local rival, the Los Angeles Kings. And being a Mighty Duck came with some perks. Players and staff were allowed free entry to Disneyland anytime they wanted. Jack Ferreira even occasionally spent his lunch break at the park. All the while, Disney was investing heavily in sports. In 1996, they purchased a stake in Major League Baseball's California Angels, later rebranding them as the Anaheim Angels. In 1997, they opened Disney's Wide World of Sports, a sprawling 220-acre, multi-use sports facility in Orlando, Florida. And the sports movies kept coming. Classics like Remember the Titans, The Rookie, and of course, Miracle. By the time production began on the third Mighty Ducks film, there was no question the NHL franchise would somehow be involved.
So what do you think of the game so far?
The Ducks are playing their hearts out, but they've got to find a way to score.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. This varsity team is big and brutal.
Oh, size isn't everything in hockey, Josh. The Ducks have the speed and the determination.
That's Paul Kariya making a cameo in D3. He didn't quit his day job.
I did the first take, and I studied my lines and everything, and the director said, it was great, Paul, but could you give a little more emotion, or could you, you know, liven it up a little bit? I go, well, this is how I do interviews. So I thought I played myself really well, but they weren't impressed with my acting.
By this point, the cast members had become a real family. Once again, here's Marguerite Moreau and Sean Weiss.
We went through puberty together. So there's like not only a shared high school experience that we went through, but I mean, we all had this ride together that only we know about. And it feels really, really special.
It was like if you've ever gone to a summer camp or, you know, survived a plane crash. That's kind of what it felt like. Our bond just kept strengthening and strengthening as we kept making the movies. We just kept getting closer and closer.
And then it was all over. Lois Yaroshevsky remembers the wrap party for D3.
The whole time, myself, Emilio, all the kids, all we did was stood in this big huddle for almost the whole party, crying. I have chills once again. Out of all the jobs I've ever done, that was the hardest to say goodbye to. It was very difficult, very difficult.
Coming up, the NHL's Mighty Ducks shock the league by acquiring a true superstar. Stay tuned.
Greetings, folks. I'm Adam Kimmelman, and I'm here with Mike Morial to remind you to check out NHL Draft Class, a podcast that covers all things NHL Draft.
That's right, Adam. If you're a hockey fan, you'll love this podcast.
Don't want to take our word for it? Well, sit back and enjoy just a small sampling of what NHL Draft Class brings to the table. Connor Bedard, thank you for joining us today on NHL Draft Class.
I'm curious, Connor. I read somewhere, true or false, that you actually turned down a trip to Disneyland because there was some kind of hockey event going on that summer?
We went once to Disneyland, and I feel like I was a little mad, I think. It's not even a big event, just open ice or fooling around with your buddies on the ice or something.
Will, I heard you're a pretty big Springsteen fan.
I like some of his songs.
Yeah? What's your favorite song?
By Born to Run.
Have you ever seen Springsteen live?
I haven't, but my dad's probably gone 15 times.
Well, he's got to take you.
I know.
Mr. Donahue, can you tell us who the Chicago Blackhawks will select with the number one pick in the 2023 NHL Draft?
Not a chance. Still got a lot of work to do. Still have a process.
Are you not entertained from interviews with the top prospects to conversations with the stable of scouts from NHL Central Scouting?
NHL Draft Class has it all. Plus, we're at all the marquee draft events, including top prospect games, the NHL Scouting Combine, and the NHL Draft, to provide the best draft coverage around.
So do yourself a favor and listen to NHL Draft Class. It's free to subscribe, and it's available on NHL.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to be in the know and be dialed in come draft season, then do the right thing and give our podcast a listen. You're officially on the clock.
The name of this team is officially the Mighty Ducks.
We went from the Mighty Ducks.
That's a true story, unfortunately.
To a team that nobody was laughing about.
These Mighty Ducks, they're not a movie, but they are the feel-good story so far.
Oh, God!
E60 presents Once Upon a Time in Anaheim. Streaming now on ESPN+.
After three hit movies, the Mighty Ducks entertainment franchise may have plateaued in 1996 with this. This is the Mighty Ducks animated series, a Saturday morning cartoon built around the Mighty Ducks mascot, Wild Wing. Steve Brill didn't watch it.
What, it's like a space thing?
I'd call it more of an interdimensional sci-fi action show. Hey, it's for the kids, okay? The point is that by the mid to late 1990s, the Mighty Ducks brand had reached a critical mass. But the NHL franchise's greatest on-ice highlight may have been their mascot, Wild Wing, catching fire following an intermission stunt gone wrong. The NHL Mighty Ducks needed a serious jump, and Jack Ferreira provided exactly that in 1996.
We needed a kick in the ass, something to get done. It was on a Friday afternoon, and Ron Wilson and I were in my office, and we were talking. Have you heard the story of rumors that Winnipeg wants to trade Solani? And I said, well, let's find out. So I called the GM, called him at home. I don't even know if I said hello. I just told him, I said, if you're trading Solani, I'll give you Tavadowski. So he says, well, let's talk on Sunday because we were going to Arizona for the GM's meetings. Craig Patrick, who was the GM of Pittsburgh, he was sitting near me at the GM's meeting and he kept asking me, what the hell are you got going? So I wrote out the trade on a 3x5 card. And I told him, there's what I've been doing. So he reads the trade and he goes, holy shit. The meeting stops. And he read the trade to everybody in the room.
The trade brought the Mighty Ducks Timu Solani. After establishing an NHL rookie record in 1992-93 with 76 goals for the Winnipeg Jets, Solani was the biggest star in his native Finland, a national icon who starred in local commercials for everything from milk to chocolate.
I'm Timo Solani, and I played the Ducks for 15 years. So I was not really expecting to get traded, and that's why it hit pretty hard. And plus, my wife was 9 months pregnant at the time.
Despite the surprise, Solani fit in, especially with his new line mate, Paul Kariya.
And now Paul Kariya
going back the other way. He's got a two-on-one with Solani. The pass, the shot, the score!
Kariya and Solani immediately became the NHL's most potent scoring pair. And just 1 year after the trade, the Mighty Ducks made the playoffs for the first time in franchise history. Michael Eisner even paid a special tribute to the team's star acquisition.
Yeah, one thing I do remember is after one game, my middle son is a big sports person, and he just got a golden retriever. And so I think he named it Temu. So I was, after the game, when I was going to the locker room, Temu Solani was getting his after-game workout with his, you know, not a massage, but things they do to bring them back to life. And I said, oh, Temu, it's great. Eric just named his dog Temu. I expected, which you would get probably from a person who was brought up in Los Angeles, hey, that's great. He looked at me like, what have you, are you naming a dog after me? He wasn't happy about it, but we never discussed it again.
2 years later, Solani and Kariya finished second and third, respectively, in league scoring. The one thing the pair was missing was a skilled center.
Somebody said, have you seen Steve Rochin?
That's David McNabb, the team's first director of player personnel and the person who convinced Jack Ferreira to select Rochin in the 1994 supplemental draft.
Knowing me, I would have said, oh, yeah, sure, I know Steve Rochin, and having no idea who he was. But I called the coach and I said, do you have any tapes of games? So he sent me two VCRs, tapes of the games, but he said, make sure you get them back because they're the only copies I got. So I watched the games, and he was spectacular. The coach called me about 2 weeks later and said, can you send me the tapes back? And I said, no, because we were picking second in that draft. Florida was picking first. I don't want Florida to take a look at these tapes.
Rochin was an unknown, but even McNabb didn't realize exactly how unknown he was.
His agent was a gentleman named Pat Morris, and the draft was in Hartford, and it was the day before the first round of the draft. And I'm talking to Steve, and Pat Morris cuts right in front of Steve and says to me, I heard Steve Rochin's in the building. Do you know where he is? Honest to God, I said, well, he's the guy you just ran over.
With their powerhouse first line, the Mighty Ducks enjoyed their first real traction as an NHL franchise. They made the 1999 postseason and faced the Detroit Red Wings, who had swept them in the second round of the playoffs 2 years earlier. Here's Steve Rochin.
I mean, of course, they had so much talent on that team, but you went into Joe Louis in those days, and you basically knew you weren't going to touch the puck. That was a tough place to win.
Outscored 17-6 by Detroit in an opening round sweep, that iteration of the Mighty Ducks never truly recovered. In March of 2001, the unthinkable happened when Pierre Gauthier, who was named GM in 1998, traded Temu Solani to the San Jose Sharks. Once again, David McNabb and Jack Ferreira.
Pierre was probably a little bit more into the money part of it. He knew that Temu was a year from coming up again for his contract. He didn't think we were good enough, which we probably weren't, to have two $10 million players.
He says, teams cannot afford two superstars.
After that, the Mighty Ducks finished last in the Pacific Division in three straight years. But things suddenly turned around heading into the 2002-2003 season, when then-Mighty Ducks general manager Brian Murray hired an unknown coach named Mike Babcock.
Brian came in and made changes. He traded and got Peter Sikora. He signed Adam Oates. He didn't accept the losing. He thought we should have been better than we had finished the year before. When we got Rob Niedermeyer, who was off the charts spectacular, and then Steve Thomas.
Jean-Sébastien Jaguer was acquired from the Calgary Flames in 2000, but he truly arrived during that 02-03 campaign, establishing a franchise record for wins in a season with 34.
Okay, my name is Jean-Sébastien Jaguer. I'm a goalie. And I played for the Anaheim Mighty Ducks.
In 2002-2003, the Mighty Ducks finished second in the Pacific and earned the 7 seed in the Western Conference, which gave them a date in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs with the defending Stanley Cup champion, Detroit Red Wings. Seriously?
I don't think that anybody believed that we would win a game. If we would have had a secret vote in the dressing room, I'm not sure we would have believed that we would have won a game. So it was a little bit scary.
Steve Ruchin agrees.
Yeah, I was just thinking, here we go again, Detroit, right? But I think what was different is that we just had a different team. We had more leaders. We just had a different mentality going into the playoffs.
Unlike previous meetings, this series with Detroit was close. After Korea scored in triple overtime to take game one, Anaheim earned one-goal wins in regulation in games two and three. In what felt like a scene out of a Disney movie, the Mighty Ducks had a chance to sweep Detroit and win a playoff series for just the second time in franchise history. Riding their veterans and their goaltender, game four also went to overtime.
They're tied right now. Here come the Ducks. It's Ruchin. Bars it in. Steve Ruchin. Right in. Saved by Joseph. Puck is still loose. Back of the net. Centers. They score! It's over! Steve Ruchin! The Ducks have swept the champs. Hockey Town is now Gulf Town. Hello, Anaheim.
Let's be honest. We had no business winning. I don't think nobody else had any business stopping them from winning the Stanley Cup, but nobody else had J.S. Chiguer.
From that point on, the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim were rolling, defeating the Dallas Stars in six games in the second round. And Jean-Sebastien Jaguar allowed just one goal in a sweep of Minnesota in the Western Conference Final. One goal. That's three shutouts in four games.
Did he get a piece of it with the paddle of his stick? Oh, he got it with the paddle of his stick.
Oh, baby.
Did he not get it with the paddle of his stick?
You dream about saves like this when you're a kid. Look at this. This is reality.
The Mighty Ducks of Anaheim, the Disney-owned team inspired by a Disney movie, were going to face the New Jersey Devils in the Stanley Cup Final. Once again, J.S. Jaguar.
So, you know, you sweep the Wild and, you know, you're about to live a dream, you know, that I've, you know, all my life, you know, when I was growing up, playing street hockey, going to the park in the winter, and it was always about the Stanley Cup. It's a bit surreal. I never thought that I would experience that. I never thought that I would be good enough to go there. It was surreal.
Winners of two Stanley Cups in the previous eight seasons, the Devils looked every bit the heavy favorite, taking the series' first two games in New Jersey. Every indication was that Anaheim's Cinderella run would end quickly. But Jean-Sebastien Jaguar had a message for the media.
We're not lucky to be here. We deserve to be here. We deserve to be in this series. We deserve to play. We deserve to have fun. We deserve to have some success, and we'll do whatever it takes to try to win.
Got it up, Madden. Look out here. Havlid trying to cut the angle. Madden in. Madden the shot. Save. Rebound. Blocked by Jaguar.
With wins in games three and four, the Mighty Ducks even the series. And in typical Mighty Ducks fashion, they took each game with a Hollywood ending in overtime. Producer Jordan Kerner remembers some very special guests in the building for those games.
I was shooting, but I think the kids went to all the games. The Ducks gave them tickets. They were all there, and I was there for two of the games, the Cup Finals. It was very integrated at Disney in terms of having the kids there because it meant a lot to the team.
Here's Marguerite Moreau.
I think I just felt like, you know, it was their time. They had played hard. They had established themselves. They had made themselves a real team. And they were maybe going to stick around. You know, they were going to make it. It was really exciting.
The Devils put the Ducks on the brink of elimination with a decisive 6-3 win in Game 5, setting up a must-win situation in Anaheim. The Mighty Ducks took a commanding 3-0 first period lead before the Devils cut the lead to 3-1 early in the second, setting the stage for an exciting final stretch. Then, just over 6 minutes into the middle period, Paul Kariya was left motionless on his back by an open ice hit from Devils captain Scott Stevens. It appeared unlikely he would return to the game. But he did return that same period.
Into the zone, Sikora kicked it out, got it back. Near side, Kariya. Kariya, the fans want one. Score! Off the floor! On the board!
Once again, David McNabb.
I remember walking around the building and it was just electrifying. You go to a sporting event, why? Because you want to see something unique. There's something spectacular. Otherwise, you can watch it on TV. You want to be there. I would have bet any we were in the Stanley Cup. I thought when he scored that goal, we were going to the Stanley Cup.
But it was not to be. New Jersey wrapped up the title with a 3-0 Game 7 win. As the Devils celebrated, the Mighty Ducks players began making their way to the visitors' locker room when one of them was suddenly summoned back to center ice.
The Conn Smythe Trophy is awarded by the Professional Hockey Writers Association to the most valuable player for the four rounds of the playoffs. This year, it's Jean-Sebastien Giguère.
Well, my emotions were mixed. I couldn't wait to get out of that ice. You know, I wanted to be with my teammates in the dressing room as all the Devils were celebrating with their family and stuff like that. It was not a fun feeling. I couldn't wait for that to be over. It was an awkward moment.
Anaheim got its cup in 2007, but by then the franchise was vastly different. Most of the team's players from the 2003 run went elsewhere, and in 2005, Disney sold the club to Henry and Susan Samueli, who rebranded the team, altering the uniforms, logo, and color scheme, and changing the name from the Mighty Ducks to the Ducks. Here's Timu Solani, who returned to Anaheim in 2005.
There's nothing like hoisting the cup, you know. Obviously, you know, it took 15 years for me to even get the chance. And there's a lot of days, a lot of years that I said, you know what, I don't think I'm ever going to get the chance to feel that moment. And the trophy was heavy and big, but you know what? That was something that it was my dream come true.
It's hard to believe the Ducks have been such an indelible part of Orange County for more than three decades. Here's how NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman quantifies their influence in the community.
What's also interesting about the Ducks, I think when the Ducks came into the league, there were three or four high school teams in Orange County, and now there are over 50 playing hockey. And so that's one of those examples of the difference that can be made by having an NHL franchise in your community.
How do you encapsulate the legacy of something that will almost definitely never happen again? A feel-good family film that became a Stanley Cup champion and one of Disney's most enduring brands. Let's go back to the man who started it all on his typewriter, Steve Brill. Not so long ago, Brill got a chance to skate with his daughter, Ella, on the ice at what was formerly known as the Pond. It was captured by a film crew as part of the E60 documentary, Once Upon a Time in Anaheim.
This is actually, I think, falls in the category of surreal, because it doesn't quite process in reality that the connections happen, that there is a NHL team and the Mighty Ducks, and I was just skating on the pond with my 13-year-old daughter. And I still don't know how to process it beyond just like smiling, enjoying it, talking about it, and being happy for it.
Thank you for listening to NHL Backstory. Once Upon a Time in Anaheim premieres on ESPN on June 11th, and it will be available on demand on ESPN+. Please make sure to like and follow, and if you really enjoyed what you heard, why not tell a friend? I'm Ardo Cal signing off. And by the way, the Flying V was totally offside and the team got away with it. NHL Backstory is produced by Matt Nicholson and Bob Bender. Produced and directed by Tal Pinchevsky. Additional production by Karen Given. Mixed by Tina Toby Mack. Portions from the Mighty Ducks films, courtesy of Disney Enterprises, Inc.